What's shaking, everybody? It's the Obligatory Talkback, the show where we step outside the narrative and break down the story from our perspective as people who have completed an entire Avatar Legends campaign.
What the how?
Yeah, weird stuff. I am one such person. My name is Ned Wilcock, your host and GM, and in this talkback, we're discussing the entire campaign up to this point, especially episode 26, our finale, which means today I'm joined by...
Caleb Anderton. I hate goodbyes.
McKenna Steele. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
And Christian Randall. See ya.
Bye now.
Well, guys, we completed an entire campaign. We made a really good story that I'm quite proud of and people seem to be enjoying. And so we're going to talk about the whole thing. And we're going to start out with some audience-suggested questions.
Woo.
We sent out a request to get questions from you guys about the campaign. Maybe there were some loose ends that we didn't wrap up that we needed to address. And we didn't get a ton of questions. So apparently, we just were super clear about everything when we were recording.
I like to take it that way.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, so the first one that we just got earlier today from Emberglow Treasures, who we've mentioned a few times on this podcast. The question is, how long has Ned known that y'all would become the foxes? This is actually something that we conspired about at the very beginning when we were talking about this campaign.
Yeah, it was fun because in the very beginning we were talking about the library and what we know about it from the show. And we knew about the foxy knowledge seekers, and we were like, well, what if we play knowledge seekers? And then kind of snowballed if, what if we are the foxes? And so it was just a little thing. Again, we did try not to play the ending and tried to have that suspension of disbelief, but we did know from even before we started.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of what inspired this campaign in the first place was we were doing the one shot and we're like, oh, that'd be so cool. The knowledge seekers are actually people. And then they turn into the foxes. And then from there, it kind of snowballed into, but let's do a whole campaign of leading up to that moment, because that'd be cool.
Yeah, there was actually, when we posted the very first episode, well, our session zero on Reddit, r/Avatar Legends, one of the comments was, because like the name of the episode was Meeting the Knowledge Seekers, and somebody commented, ooh, are the Knowledge Seekers foxy? And I was like, ooh, just you wait.
They will be in 26 episodes.
I will say, shout out to Emberglow Treasures. Love your work. A lot of cool pottery stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, with the idea of knowing that we were going to become the foxes, this is, I guess, an example of a technique that's called retroscripting. The idea being that you kind of know where the scene's going to start, and you have an idea of where you want the scene to end, and you make up everything in between. You leave that completely up to improvisation. And it's a technique that I think they used in What We Do in the Shadows, the movie. They used in home movies. I can't remember the name of the show right now, but it's really great, made by Brendan Small and some other really talented people. And I guess this was just one huge, long retro script with just a lot of wiggle room in the middle.
Yeah.
Loved it. I've been so stoked about the idea the entire time, and I'm so glad that we found a fun little niche in the Avatar world to slide ourselves into there to connect ourselves to the larger canon, you know, taking some creative liberties.
That kind of does make me think of a question for you again, Ned.
Yeah.
Honestly, before we started our session zero, we had a better idea of the ending than we did the beginning. Like we had the, you know, library heist episode as our quote unquote beginning.
The inciting incident, if you will.
Yeah, so that was there. And then we knew kind of where we wanted to end up with that idea of us turning into those foxes. And you just said that there was a lot of wiggle room. How much do you feel like went quote-unquote, according to your plan, like us going from Bossing Say to the swamp to that sort of crescendo avalanche that happened at the end?
Yeah, when we started out the game right at the very beginning, the only thing that I really had an idea of a place where I wanted to go as the GM, we never actually ended up going to. Everything kind of took a pretty sharp right turn right from the very beginning. When we started putting the characters together, we knew that, okay, Zaya wants to go to the Foggy Swamp, so we're probably going to end up there. Then we did the session zero, we talked about the inciting incident. It's like, okay, obviously we're going to be going to Bossing Say. And when we got to that point, I kind of figured, okay, we're going to start going to Bossing Say, then we're going to the Foggy Swamp. And then the place that I thought maybe we were going to go after that was a city called Taku. And Taku only exists in one Avatar episode, and they never actually mention it by name. It's the episode where Sokka and Katara get sick, and Aang has to go off and find the frogs and has to evade the UN archers.
Yeah.
They're in this massive, beautiful, tiered city built into the side of a mountain, and there's these huge badger mole statues, and like Momo's going off and grabbing crowns and pieces of jewelry and bringing them back to Katara. And I'm like, what is this city? And I looked it up, and it's this city called Taku. It's on the western edge of the Earth Kingdom, and back in the day, it was like the agricultural center of the Earth Kingdom. Because it was so close to the Fire Nation, all of the goods passed through Taku before being dispersed into the rest of the Earth Kingdom. And I looked at that and I thought, this is a really rich vein that we could tap into. There's very little that's established about it in the canon, so we could just really go wild with this city. In fact, the only other way that it's been kind of touched on is FCE, the guy who writes the novels for previous Avatars, he's commented that he thinks the next Yang Chen novel is going to take place at least partially in Taku.
Oh, cool.
So we'll get to see it fleshed out a bit there. But when we got to the end of the Foggy Swamp arc and Amar's family just kind of materialized out of nowhere, it became much more important for us to follow that thread because that was player driven as opposed to following my thread that I was interested in following. And we did kind of mention it towards the end there when Taya was having that big tirade at the very end, like, hey, we're attacking all of the nations at once. What are you going to try and save? Because that is something that we do know canonically. There was a sort of lore book that was released after the original series that expanded on some stuff that says, yes, Lord Sozin attacked not only all four air temples, but he also launched a coordinated attack against the Earth Kingdom and the Water Tribes. It doesn't say specifically where they attacked, so I assumed that for the Southern Water Tribe, they'd probably attack Wolf Cove, because that's the capital of the Southern Water Tribe. And we do know that Taku was destroyed very early on in the Hundred Year War because the Fire Nation wanted to cripple that big economic stronghold that the Earth Kingdom had.
That makes sense.
So yeah, I figured, especially since they're so close to the Fire Nation and since they're such a massive influence, that probably would be the first place that the Fire Nation would attack in the Earth Kingdom.
Oh, that is cool. That's definitely something I feel like I'll want to explore later in the future somehow, because that episode is super cool and does leave a lot of questions. Just this sort of destroyed, powerful city in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So really, that was kind of the only place that I, from the beginning, was like, this is where I'm kind of interested in going. I figured the showdown with Tai would probably take place in Taku, and then maybe you guys would be kind of embroiled in the midst of that attack. But then the story wanted us to go in a different, much more personal direction, and I'm not mad about that. I think it resolved in a very good way.
Way to go, Ned, putting aside your own assumptions for the story and letting the story tell itself.
That's a good DM move.
Ah, thank you. But part of the great thing about prepping for a story like this is basically I had the idea that maybe we would go to Taku, but I told myself I don't need to plan for all that stuff right now because I can just create a general roadmap and fill in all the details as we go. So when it ended up happening that we weren't going to go to Taku, I was like, I don't have to throw away any prep because I didn't do any prep. There we go.
Perfect.
Let's see. Another specific question that we got from our listeners, Tim Rust, one of our new patrons, asked, what happened to Marmar? Did he become a tiny fox that rides on Zaya's back? Did he get feathered? Was Marmar actually a spirit the whole time?
Ooh.
So, McKenna, could you elucidate for us some of your thoughts about Marmar that didn't get talked about in the campaign?
First, before I say anything further, my want is that Marmar turns into a little tiny fox and just rides along my back because I think that's hilarious. But, some stuff about Zaya that did not really get to come out was how her and Marmar developed that relationship. So it was at her brother's funeral. Obviously she's an emotional wreck. She's going through lots of things in her brain. Blaming herself, mourning her brother, and then this little white hamster, which they were, you know, trying to catch and make into like a pet or whatever and just have fun or let it go, all of a sudden just kind of tugged at her pant leg, crawled up, and just kind of nuzzled into her, and she was like, that's really weird. So she names it after her brother because her brother's name is Mar. And so she named him Marmar because she felt kind of like this was a way for her brother to say, it's okay, I'm still here with you, So the way she sees it is either, you know, this is my brother being with me, or just a sign of, hey, it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. And you left it kind of ambiguous in your backstory that you sent to me in terms of, you know, it's easy for this idealist young girl to look at this hamster and say, this is my little brother, come back to stay with me and to comfort me. And in a sense, we could kind of play it Schrodinger's hamster, like maybe he really is just a hamster. And like Wan Chitong says in the series, and as he reiterates at the end of this campaign, humans are no longer allowed in his library. There's nothing that says hamsters aren't allowed in the library. So we could just be like, yeah, I mean, Marmar is just a regular old hamster that gets to stick around and be with his friends. But then I had a realization as I was looking deeper into it. So Zaya is, what, 23-ish in the campaign, did we decide?
General age, yeah. I think that might have been what I said, yeah.
And in your backstory, Zaya met Marmar when she was 9 years old. And as somebody who grew up in a house that had lots of hamsters, hamsters don't live to be 14 years old.
No.
They always die in the weirdest, most horrifying ways is what happens.
Horrifying.
Yeah, but even if a hamster does live through the full length of its life, you're looking at an average of like 2 to 3 years for the lifespan of a hamster, not 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we take this into account, I think there's a very good chance that Marmar is your brother's spirit come back into a physical form to be with you.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
Which is what I would like to think, but I also enjoy the ambiguity of it. But now that you bring that up, yeah, that kind of makes more sense. There's no way a hamster's living that long. I don't know, unless water tribe hamsters, you know, white hamsters are just like some genetically advanced hamster.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe this will end up being a death of the author kind of situation where it's like the story stands as it is, whether the audience wants to assume that Marmar's just a regular hamster or if he's actually Mar's spirit given physical form. One of them kind of touches my heart a little bit more and maybe also kind of explains his super animal intelligence and his ability to give people finger guns and whatnot, but it is what it is.
Not the explanation I was expecting from hamster finger guns was he's a spirit.
I mean, what other type of hamster would give finger guns?
It's true.
A spirit hamster.
Exactly.
We're going to have a bunch of different AUs where he's a fox, he's a hamster, he's a spirit.
I personally will be in the one where he's a fox because that's funny.
Mm-hmm. And we got one final question from our audience, and this is a question that I think is going to tie in a lot to some of the stuff we're going to discuss here. This comes from Demon Download, who is one of our patrons as well. The first part of it's a question, the last part of it is just sort of a commentary, so I'm just going to read the whole thing. The question is, how does playing with an established canon affect the roleplay and character decisions you all make compared to the more anything-goes Fate settings? For what it's worth, I think you're all doing an amazing job balancing the Avatar I know with incredible deep characters and an exciting, surprising story. Love the show, equal parts sad to hear we're reaching the end of this part of, the Knowledge Seeker's journey, and excited to hear the Blades in the Dark stuff. So first of all, thank you, Demon Download, for your kind words.
Thank you!
Trying to fit our story around the canon has been an interesting challenge, but not in a bad way, I would say. We've talked previously in the obligatory talkback about creativity within a certain constraint and how that actually is a benefit to the creative process because it gives you some direction. And we've talked so much about not trying to play the end from the beginning and making sure that we are honoring this amazing world that we're getting to play around in. I don't know. I've got plenty of thoughts, but I'll pass this over to my players for a bit because I've spoken ad nauseum about this subject already.
I will say I was a big proponent of keeping this as close to the canon as possible. Like from the very beginning, even when we had some roadblocks come up pretty early, we had the one shot, the library heist, where, surprise, the library is not buried in the sand.
Mm-hmm.
We were planning on starting out with that still there, and then the Wan Chitong's adventure guide came out, and it gave a little bit of a timeline for like when the library was buried, and we're like, shoot, it's kind of supposed to be already buried by this time, is what it seems like. So is this just a alternate universe? Is this, what do we do? How do we still make this canon? Or do we just give up and it's not canon anymore? Or, you know, our version of canon.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when we brought in a sandbender, Xin Lai, to clean it up and hopefully give Wan Chitong some new hope in not just letting it be buried by the sands of apathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think personally that it's really fun getting to create within the box of established canon. because you have somebody else to stand by. And if you can create something that lives up to what they've already done and doesn't feel like it cheapens it in any way, I think that's fun. That's good. That's a hard standard to live up to, and I like holding ourselves to that.
Yeah, and I think people love the Avatar series because the original creators established a very certain and kind of specific tone and world mm-hmm. that these stories are existing in, and that's what people have fallen in love with about Avatar. And so I feel like if we want to be able to treat the Avatar fans right, we want to present for them a world that is as similar as possible to the world that they have fallen in love with. Yes, we give ourselves some wiggle room within that to discuss the origins of the Knowledge Seekers, to create new places like Tekak, but still we are making sure that the reason why people fell in love with the show in the first place continues to be the reason why they're going to want to stick around for our show. Mm-hmm. And I think in regards especially to the last few episodes of the campaign, this particular issue of working within the canon kind of drove it at an unexpectedly fast pace towards the end of the story.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
One thing that I have thought a lot about during the course of this campaign is what makes a good prequel, what makes a bad prequel, and probably my personal favorite prequel is Star Wars Rogue One.
Yes!
They treated the story very, very well, and if you look at the end of Rogue One, the last few beats of Rogue One mirror perfectly the first few beats of A New Hope. And so I wanted to do kind of a similar thing with this campaign, that our campaign ends right as we're seeing like the first few moments of the original series of Avatar The Last Airbender, right before Aang disappears and goes into the iceberg and whatnot. And so there's a couple specific things with that as well in terms of what to do with these specific characters. And in Rogue One, when they ran into this question, they were like, okay, well, we know in the established canon of A New Hope, all we've really got about the people who are in the Rogue One mission is many people died to get us this knowledge about the Death Star. And so they went into that like, okay, we've got these really cool characters that get along really well, have great chemistry and great presence, but do they all just die at the end? I mean, that's what makes sense for the story. And they were kind of scared to pitch that to Disney because Disney is a pretty family-friendly kind of institution. But Disney came back and they were like, no, that makes sense with the story. And so that's what we ended up with. Sorry, spoilers for Star Wars Rogue One, a movie that's been out since 2015, 16?
16,
like
yeah.
If you haven't seen it at this point, that's kind of on you.
Mm-hmm. So similarly, there was this question for me of what are we going to do with the Knowledge Seekers beyond this point? Do they just like keep going out and doing their own little thing in the world? And I mean, like we have in the canon, Aang is the last airbender. So if we just go with that assumption, that means Jetsun goes back out into the world and he gets killed pretty early on in the Hundred Year War. Do we want that to happen?
No.
I don't want
no,
that to happen.
No.
And we got a few comments as we were like kind of hinting at, hey, we're reaching the end of this campaign. And like Demon Download just said, I'm equal parts sad to hear that we're reaching the end of this part of, and he said in parentheses, question mark, cross fingers emoji. And another comment that we got on our Patreon poll that we made when we were talking about the next campaign we want to do, I can't remember off the top of my head who it was from, but said, I'm really sad to hear that we're going to be saying goodbye to these characters. Hope we can see more from them in the future. And I would see those kind of comments and be like, oh, my sweet friends, here's the problem. Because of like the situation that we put them in from the very beginning, they can't come back, or at least not in the state that they are. And that left me with kind of a sour taste in my mouth almost, left me feeling very sad. And I was kind of going into the finale thinking, is it going to be possible for us to end this campaign on a lighthearted note? Because I was very surprised towards the end, and maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was very surprised at how emotional the story got. Mm-hmm. It does make sense because this story is leading up to a genocide followed by a war that's going to last 100 years.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that this story is going to be very emotional and get kind of sad in some places. And right at the very end, I was like, how can we possibly end this on a high note? And I think we managed to pull it off in the end.
I felt like it was a high note.
Honestly, the cut forward you did, the little epilogue.
Yes.
Ned.
That was so good.
That was the big high note. That was chef's kiss, my dude.
I feel like it did a lot of things. One of the things it did is it told everyone that, yes, they may not continue as they were, but they will continue. You know, the knowledge seekers are still there, and they're still doing something, and they're still together. They have gone through loss and trials, and you can assume that's continued to happen over the 100 years, but they have each other, and they are persisting.
Well, and another thing with that flash forward, I mean, the whole point, the mission they were trying to accomplish is trying to prevent whatever's going to happen to the Avatar, whatever, this crazy war that Sozin is trying to start and did start. And so I think it's also kind of that satisfaction for the three of them to be like, oh, look, that is, I mean, we've got to know, like, the Avatar at this point. We've gathered knowledge. And so it's probably kind of that we were able to help in some way, maybe, but it didn't stay bad forever. All the work we did wasn't in vain for anything.
Yeah, and even as we were leading up to that moment where, like, okay, we have this expectation that we're going to turn into the foxes, and that's how your story kind of continues, in my mind, there was still kind of this melancholy about the entire thing. It's like, oh man, these people had this grand adventure, and now they're just going to be cooped up in this dusty old, sandy old library for the rest of time. But then, as Wan Chitong was having that final conversation with you, as he was kind of presenting that ultimatum, I started rationalizing to myself in that moment. It's like, wait, no, they wouldn't be just stuck here in the library. They need to go out into the world if they're going to collect knowledge and bring it back to him. That's the very first thing we see of the Knowledge Seekers, is one of the foxes coming back from outside in the world. And that opened up a very nice, bright light in terms of giving you guys a happier ending, that sure, you're going to be a foxy Knowledge Seeker, but you can still go back and talk to your dad, like you promised you were going to. You can still go back and spend time with Kiyumi and meet these people that you saw along the way, maybe weren't able to wrap things up with as much as you hoped. You still have that chance, just in a different way.
Huli, who makes the tea?
That's the only person Jetsun Wynn saw.
I like to imagine that eventually you can walk through Ba Sing Se and see a tea shop with a fox as the little logo.
That'd be cute.
I just wanted to say, I love that this was a way to literally immortalize these characters that I know we came to love, and that I hope other people came to love as well. It's just cool to know that they're literally immortal now. That's really fun to me.
Mm-hmm.
Something completely goofy. As far as our fur color goes, I like to think that Amar has like this kind of like fiery red.
Oh yeah.
And then Jetsun has like a little golden, kind of like his like airbender clothing. But there's a few parts that are just kind of patchy because he's actually bald. And then Zaya's is like black fur, and she's just got like a little white spot,
yeah,
like from her hair. But I mostly like the fact that you have a couple patchy spots, Christian, because I think that's quite funny to me.
I like to imagine that they're not bald; they're just like white patches, and I do like to imagine there's a little arrow patch on the forehead.
Ooh, that's fun.
Nah, bald.
Yeah, in terms of having some silly fun with the Knowledge Seekers now that they're foxes, I do think now that we have kind of wrapped it up for them in this way, I think there's room to see the Knowledge Seekers again as foxes in maybe a one-shot or two in the future.
Yeah, and you know what? It doesn't even have to be the near future as far as like this campaign goes. It could be a way future Avatar one-shot that we're doing like post-Korra era, and we're still around.
Yeah, I mean, you see the Knowledge Seekers again in The Legend of Korra. Iroh's hanging out with one of them in the spirit world.
That's right.
I like to imagine that's me.
Oh, but I want it to be me, but it does make more sense for you, but I do so want it to be me.
Well, I'm sure we're all friends with him, but we have that old man bond.
See, another thought that I have kind of in response to Demon Download's question of playing within the canon. One interesting story thing for me was, especially to not play the end from the beginning, like, as soon as the Knowledge Seekers discover who has those scrolls, as soon as they discover that Lord Sozin is the one who wanted these, that's probably like that triggers the end game of the entire campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, it's like, oh, we know that Sozin is super sketchy. We're already worried about why these scrolls have been taken. We got to go try and stop Sozin before he does something crazy. And so there was even a particular moment earlier on in the campaign that made my heart jump out of its boots a little bit. After you guys returned from bossing Sei to the library and Amar pulled out that letter, the one that he didn't send to Lord Sozin,
yeah,
and showed that to Jetsun, in that moment I was like, wait a second, if they find out, oh boy. And so that's why I had Loeb Sang come in and say, well, I mean, at least if Taya, blah, 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 that means Lord Sozin doesn't have him, right? Deliberately trying to throw you guys off the scent so we could keep things going for a little bit longer.
That's so funny, because that my brain didn't even think about that.
I did not think about that either as far as a potential trigger for the end game. I just honestly remembered that, oh yeah, I have this and I guess I trust these people now. I should probably share this with them. And it just felt natural. So
I also think as our characters, we were so in the mindset of the four nations live in harmony. Like mm-hmm. I mean, even when you presented that, Jetsun, like Christian obviously knew what was happening, but Jetsun, he couldn't conceptualize the idea that what was going to happen could happen. Because that just doesn't make sense to him. It doesn't track. And so it wasn't really until...
The Fire Nation town?
Yudao.
Yeah.
Yes, Yudao.
And even in Yudao, and even in Taekak, it didn't really sink in until we were having the confrontation in the library that it was like, oh, this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
After I saw what Amar could do with his firebending, we got there and I was like, oh, if all firebenders can do this, this can actually be a thing.
Not all firebenders can fly through the air on a Fifi. That was so fun. I loved it.
That was so good.
Mm-hmm. Really nice that we got to pay off that moment in a pretty spectacular way.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That kind of brings me to just a question I had as well, and I think this might be Caleb's answer, but doesn't everyone have a favorite moment that sticks out to you from the story?
In general?
We're talking about the whole thing, beginning to end here, so... I mean, there's so many crazy shenanigans from buzzard wasps, pie show, swamps.
Cactus juice pie.
I forgot about all of that.
Yeah, it's wild to me looking back on sort of the different arcs of this campaign. And the pie show arc felt so different from the Dai Li arc, felt so different from the foggy swamp. And so many different emotions that I have attached to the different parts of this story.
They're so different. It's like comparing apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. You can't... I can pick one from each. Does that work for you?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, because to me, they don't, they feel distinct, but not disparate. Like, it still feels like a very cohesive thing that happened.
Oh, yeah.
But there was, I mean, we talked about it earlier about the difference between the external issues we were facing to the internal. It went from we're searching for some stolen scrolls to, oh, we've got these personal, interpersonal issues to, oh, we have these intercontinental issues.
It was man versus man versus self, and then man versus
nature.
Mm-hmm.
I have several. One big one for my character is Amar. He was kind of incomplete without Fifi for most of that campaign. And I'm just so glad that even though we had Fifi for such a short amount of time, in the campaign, that comet-powered Fifi all the way back to the library made it feel like it was the quality, not the quantity of time.
Yeah.
So that really was a special connection back. My character felt whole for the first time, I feel like, in the whole campaign. Another one, I was also very happy that Amar got a teeny tiny little kiss at the very end.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite moments.
Same.
Yeah. One response I have real quick with Fifi is Fifi gained a lot of deep narrative significance for the whole campaign right there at the end.
Yeah.
And that was largely in response to, like I said, I was thinking the showdown with Tai would probably happen in Taku. But afterwards, when we took that different direction, I was like, how much more impactful will it be if the final confrontation happens in the library and you guys are there when Wan Chitong starts sinking it down beneath the sands?
Yes.
And so needed to figure out a reason, you're kind of going on this goose chase from place to place, trying to find Taya, resolving some stuff in Yudao, resolving Taekak. Why are we going to bring you back to the library specifically? And I was like, we'll just put something inside Fifi, you know?
Well, Ned, I'm a little behind in listening through the episodes. I'm doing it with my wife. She is listening to them at the same time as well. And I was shocked because I didn't even realize, but you're like, yeah, you hear stuff like rattling around in there that's definitely not supposed to be rattling around in these pieces as you throw them in the corner. Do you want to use the new pieces? And I'm like, heck yeah, of course I'm going to use the new pieces. Like, okay, you just hear things rattling. Mm-hmm. Like, it was all there. All the clues were there. I could have, if I had been paying more attention, gone like, now, wait a minute. I want to look inside, make sure nothing's in there, and found that canister. But I didn't. And that was really fun.
Yeah.
I just, narratively, I'm a big fan of the way that was handled because I read a lot of books and stories and whatnot where if the people had cell phones, 99% of the problems would go away because it's all just miscommunication and not people not talking to each other. But this one wasn't, like, realistically, we basically did everything we could. These characters weren't really selfish or distrusting or, you know, they were really trying to just do the best they could with what they had, and they just still couldn't do it because it was bigger than them, it was beyond them. And I don't know, it didn't feel like frustrating to me at any point where it was like, oh, if I could just get this information from this person, we could solve a million problems. It was always, it felt very natural in that way.
Yeah, in answer to the comment about this being much bigger than us, there was a comment, Christian, that you made in, I think, the last talk back as we were talking about what was going on in Yudao and coming to this realization that all this stuff is going on. And you made a comment something to the effect of, there were just so many hooks, but we couldn't grab them because we had to follow this other thing. And I know we've talked a little bit in that episode about the conflict that we were feeling about realizing there's all this stuff going on and walking away from it, choosing to let that kind of be its own thing in order to pursue this other more immediate goal. Like, yes, there were a lot of hooks that we could have explored, but I think if we had, we would have started stepping on the canon of the original story. Like, if you stay in Yudao and you start, like, digging into this dissension between the Earth Kingdom and the Fire Nation, is that going to take you to Lord Sozin? It's like, are we going to try and confront Lord Sozin and try and stop the genocide from happening? So, yes, there were so many hooks that were being presented to you, but I think there were hooks that, in order to maintain our relationship with the canon, we couldn't allow ourselves to follow, really.
Yeah, it was fun to play with that, again, interpersonal tension with, you know, McKenna wanting to jump in there as the idealist, wanting to help and wanting to do that, but having to come to the realization that she couldn't because, yeah, like you were saying, there was that immediate threat, especially since it was such a close, you know, a parental threat, a family member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some of these hooks as well, like if we use Yudao specifically as an example, sure, you guys didn't grab that hook, but we know that that hook does get grabbed later on. There's an entire comic trilogy that takes place after the original series where Aang and his friends go to Yudao and they dig really deep into the tension between the two nations and how they're trying to live in harmony and whatnot.
Oh, cool.
And so a lot of these hooks that we left untouched are hooks that we know are going to get resolved at some point in the future. But even the ones that maybe are left ambiguous, I think those are hooks that we leave open for other people to explore in their own campaigns during the Hundred Year War.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the fun thing about this being set in the past, and I like that it's set in just before kind of the Hundred Years War, so the first real thing we get obviously is Avatar The Last Airbender, the show. That's our very first exposure to the world of Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are really starting just before that very first thing. Of course, now there are books written prior to that, there are shows that happen well after that, and books and comics and everything. But I'm really glad we started where we did. I feel like it, if we're gonna, you know, leap into this Avatar verse, if you will, starting in a similar position to where the original started feels right.
Mm-hmm. See, there's a couple other things that I kind of want to touch on particularly. One is I was talking with Ellie, who we've mentioned countless times already. We were talking about how the pieces kind of started getting put together towards the end. You know, if I were to talk about some of my personal favorite moments from throughout the entire campaign, I think emotionally and narratively speaking, Zaya's vision in the foggy swamp Ooh. Is certainly right up near the top of my list.
That is my number one.
Yeah, still still to this day, that left such a strong impact on me. And every time I go back and listen to it again, kind of gives me some chills. But from kind of a narrative and kind of puzzle putting together perspective, a lot of my MO throughout this campaign was I have all the details and I need to make sure that I'm laying them out at such a pace that we can follow the thread from place to place, but we still keep up the tension, making sure that I drip just enough information to bring you along. And the first like major instance of that, well, I guess the first major one was revealing that Taya was a member of the Dai Li, but the revelation that Amar had been brainwashed by the Dai Li was kind of like the first real narrative triumph for me as the scheming GM. And so I was talking with Ellie about all the pieces kind of coming together. And Ellie was like, I know that you and Christian talked a lot about how it's hard to play a character that's smarter than you. And Christian's pretty smart. He put a lot of that together in a pretty interesting way. So I just kind of want to readdress this topic real quick and maybe talk about kind of the difference between intelligence and wisdom. I think more of the difficulty that you have with Jetsun and some of the difficulty that I have with Fleeple, for example, in I Cast Fireball, he's supposed to be more of a sage-like character. Like, sure, we can put the pieces together with our brains in that intelligent sort of way, but the expectation that you'll be able to just kind of spout something off the top of your head that sounds rich and profound and life-changing, that's where the difficulty comes in.
Well, and just jumping in, I want to applaud you, Ned, just not everyone who listens to the podcast or, you know, experiences art has had the experience that kind of you were talking about, where you had that vision in the foggy swamp with Taya. Dang it. Nope. Where you had that vision in the foggy swamp with Zaya, and you created something in the moment that you were not aware of being able to create. It happened. The moment was in itself pure. It happened. That creative moment existed and we were lucky enough to capture it. And so just that is something that I think is so cool. And again, jumping back to that whole playing someone smarter than you or more wise than you or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me is one of those, I you know, there's a collective consciousness. We all have wisdom within us somewhere and sometimes it comes out. And so it's really cool that you were able to capture that moment and still be affected by it. Mm-hmm. I just think it's really cool.
Yeah. And that speaks to some of the stuff we've talked about in earlier conversations about this, where it's like sometimes you just have to kind of trust that this character you're representing is going to say something wise, because a lot of wisdom is very specific to a specific person's specific circumstances that they're in at that moment. And it's because of the journey that we'd seen Zaya going through over the past few episodes that when she sees herself reflected in that ice, that it truly becomes impactful in that moment. We could have had that earlier on in the campaign and it still would have been like, oh yeah, this is a cool moment, but without the self-doubt leading up to it, it wouldn't have been as impactful.
McKenna, I'm very glad that our characters were never required to spout wisdom out of nowhere.
Oh, same.
Real glad that we did not put that pressure on ourselves.
I try to avoid always putting that pressure. That will never happen, because if you can't tell from me trying to talk in a talk back, I am not eloquent. I say but and like a lot. So the least amount of times I have to talk well, the better.
Yeah, I mean, why would somebody willingly decide to portray the spirit of knowledge in a podcast, am I right?
I know. Absurd.
Let's see. You know, I've mentioned some specific favorite moments. Caleb's mentioned some specific favorite moments. What about you guys?
Well, like I said, all the visions that Zaya had were incredible. The first one just took me a while to emotionally calm down from. But it felt therapeutic in a way for myself as McKenna. I don't know why. I don't know what trauma I'm working through right now, but apparently I've got some I have a lot I haven't worked on. I just didn't know which one it was, is more of what I'm saying. But that was definitely one of my favorite moments. The interaction at the end with Zaya and Amar I really liked that it was Zaya that initiated it at the end. I mean, Amar had been kind of hinting at things, and Zaya had kind of been like, And I think there needed to be some initiative on her side for the relationship or whatever to move forward. And it still would have meant a lot for Amar to do something, but I was like, no, Zaya needs to be the one to say, I haven't said this before, but I'm saying it now. Please stay. And that moment was just very tender to my heart. And as far as goofy ones, I really liked my walk pun.
Yes.
And I was really proud of it.
Yeah, we got a lot of comments after we released that episode being like, how did you not get walking on sunshine?
That's what I was going to do. But then I was like, I feel like it's too obvious.
Too easy of a grab.
Low hanging fruit.
Got to show that I thought about it. It is still a good one, but I needed to challenge myself.
Yeah, you have sparked some stuff in my brain that I want to respond to some of the stuff you said. First, when I was saying that the vision that Zaya had in the foggy swamp, I realized now, oh yeah, there were two visions that were both very impactful. Originally, I was talking about the first vision that you had, because I think just with the circumstances surrounding that, like all of you getting separated, and as sadistic as it is, the fact that you ended up being the only one that had a negative vision.
Oh, it was magical to me. Story-wise, I was like, this is perfect, and nothing bad could happen right now, even though it was like a terrifying vision, it was still like, this is the only thing that should happen.
Yeah. So that was the one I was originally talking about, but dang it, both of them are quite good and quite impactful for different reasons.
So good. Ned, you did amazing.
Oh, thank you. And then in response to the comment about Amar and Zaya interacting at the end, I don't think we mentioned this while we were recording. I think this was just kind of during our banter after we stopped the recording. But as Jetsun and Zaya were starting to like give their reasoning for why they will sacrifice everything else to stay at the library and to forward the cause of knowledge and wisdom, I felt like I was kind of watching Caleb up in the corner being like, I just met my dad again for the first time in who knows how long, and we had this really great interaction, and I promised I was going to come back. I could kind of see the wheels turning almost of you being like, how am I going to justify staying here at the library instead of going back to my dad?
Mm-hmm. I was so grateful for McKenna's gift in making Zaya initiate that part by extending that invitation of please stay. Because yes, there absolutely was, like, Amar had a lot of reasons to not be there. And also, Amar has also kind of been on the pursuing side in this relationship. And to finally have that turned around and have an invitation meant everything to him. So that for those two reasons put together, I was so grateful that McKenna saw that, felt it, and went with it. Well done.
I mean, art imitates life. And I was just pulling on mine and Krish's relationship because it was
that's true.
Right there.
Real quick, that also reminded me, I will say visions were cool, but another absolute favorite moment for me was the big reveal that Jetsun's actions killed Amar's mother.
Yes.
And the fact that it was in that moment that you decided that had happened.
Yes.
Loved that.
It was big, it was scary, but it felt so good. Oh, I'm just so glad that that happened and it all lined up the way it did for that, because that was good stuff.
Well, and what led after it, looking back, I realized I had completely forgotten until right now that you had just said, we're gonna roll with it and see what happens. I had completely forgot until y'all just said it, and I was like, holy crap, no, wait. That wasn't originally the plan. So well done in continuing the story upon that gift, like, and making it into this beautiful thing with it.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my, like you guys were saying that it's so hard to choose favorites, but the moment you took that story that felt, as I was saying it and telling it, felt a little disconnected, a little unjustified as to why it was still affecting me so much or why it was even impactful to the story, and tied it in such a personal way and made it matter. That was such a huge gift. And I know you felt like you were taking a big leap and, you know, trusting your scene partner, but you, I felt like I was the one floundering and you're the one who caught me is what it felt like.
Thank you. I'm glad. Man, that's actually a really nice thing to know. Man, I love improv. It's so fun.
So good.
And I know it's silly, but one of my favorite moments was that very first fight with the buzzard wasps.
Yes.
It was messy. We didn't know what we were doing. We didn't understand the system yet. But I felt like an airbender.
Yeah.
I feel like you two got into a little bit more trouble than I did, especially when like we were split up in Bossing Se. And even a few other times, I felt like Jetsun occasionally got to flex his airbending muscles and show off some cool stuff. But that first moment, I felt like an airbender, and that was just such a cool experience.
I mean, I've talked about this before. It was kind of shocking to see you pull out these powerful airbending moves, and it was really cool. It was a whole new side of Jetsun.
It was informative as a character, and that was just super fun.
Another one of favorite moments, any interaction with Wan Shi Tong for me, like, I felt like I was talking to, like, my long-lost grandfather that I've never met, and it was just the most comforting, and just, like, hearing you do Wan Shi Tong's voice, I don't know why. I just, every single time, I was like, oh, my heart is warm, my soul is being healed, and I feel like I could solve any problem just because it was so warm and comforting, and, like, half the time, I feel like I was emotional just because I was like, you were proud of me? Okay, thanks. Oh, you gave me a hug. Okay, thanks.
Did you feel like Princess Mia Thermopolis?
Because oh my gosh.
The voice?
Yes.
Good old Joe.
I think my favorite thing about the interactions between Wan Shi Tong and Xia was I got to have those moments where it's like, Wan Shi Tong's just an awkward little guy, you know?
He's just a little awkward guy. He's so cute.
He doesn't know how to have social interactions with people. He doesn't know how to end a hug with somebody.
But they're so cute.
Man, I'm just now realizing, like, we all talked about our favorite moments in the campaign in a very reasonable, let's wrap up this episode sort of fashion, but we haven't actually talked about a lot of specific moments in the finale yet.
Oh, you're right.
Which there were some major ones.
Major. And I would like to start with a specific one because I have a question for you, Ned.
Yes.
So I love Taya. Yes, I am saying Taya, not Xia. I do love Xia. I love Taya. Did you always plan to have her go in that way with, like, the feathers and going into, like...
Send her to the Shadow Realm.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. That was very late in the planning process. One thing that changed a lot for me leading up to the finale was when Xia unlocked her moment of balance. Because it was like, oh, I was planning on having this really long, drawn-out confrontation with the boss at the end of the campaign... But Xia can just end that whenever she wants to.
Yeah, I can. And I did.
Yeah. And so, oh man, it was this interesting moment of like, do we try to have a redemption arc for Taya? Do we try and like in this really intense moment right at the very end in Wan Shi Tong's library, what would Wan Shi Tong do? And that's one thing that as the GM, you should always be asking yourself is how is the world reacting to what the players are doing? And so that was the mystery clock that I was starting to tick as you guys entered into that first exchange. You know, she coughs up some feathers. I'm ticking this mystery clock. That was Wan Shi Tong arrives on the scene.
Oh.
So if you guys had, you guys could have gone on and fought for a few more rounds, but eventually Wan Shi Tong was going to show up. And at that point, like, he's a vindictive spirit who has just had it proved to him that his softness, his tenderness in allowing the library to stay above the sands did some really bad stuff for the entire world. So it would have, yeah, it would have been cool if we could have had a more redemption arc kind of moment for Taya, but I don't think it fit with the narrative that we ended up creating in the circumstances that we did.
No.
No. This was the only option.
It would not have been earned, I feel.
No.
It would have felt sloppy.
It would have taken like a full another arc to earn any sort of redemption.
But this was, this was kind of dark and kind of beautiful. And gosh, what a cool thing.
Because like, you know, we've said before, it all started with Avatar: The Last Airbender. But Aang was a kid and the show was, you know, the show reflected that. Korra is a lot darker at times. She's older and has a lot, you know, some darker moments. If you read the Kyoshi novels, they're a lot darker. So like the depths already exist. And I don't think we necessarily hit all of the highs and all of the lows that, you know, the breadth of all canon covers. But it felt within the bounds. Everything that we did felt within the bounds of what had already been established as the mood, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one thing with that final confrontation that I'm realizing in hindsight that maybe I didn't narratively justify as well as I could have was, like, Wan Shi Tong comes in, he knows that the person who stole the scrolls is here in this room, but how does he know that the world is falling apart because of what this woman did? And I think we can probably just kind of chalk that up to Spirit World shenanigans.
Like, Spirit World shenanigans.
That's the vibe I got.
He's
I mean,
the best scapegoat.
I'm sure if, you know, Sozin's comet is going over, the Spirit World is full of energy. And if they are literally genociding, the spirit world is in turmoil. So I'm sure he's he's feeling a great disturbance in the force.
Exactly. What I was going to say.
But I do love the poetry that, and Christian, A plus to you, gold star for this, taking it to the planetarium for the final confrontation.
Oh, yes.
It was, I saw the moment, I was like, oh, that would be the moment. Because it's like, first off, it's Amar's baby in a way. So like, it's relevant to our character. It was the thank you. Yeah, that was a super fun thing that, again, I didn't plan for. I just saw the moment.
Plus, you know that the comet is in the sky of the planetarium, and it's also in the real sky all at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, in the mind's eye, the cinematics of that final moment were just so intense.
Everybody falling from a great height, just trying to fight in midair.
And then as we're talking, you know, sand is starting to pour in. It's all just happening, and Wan Shitong is stomping his feet and we're feeling the descent. Ugh, it's just epic.
Causes a lot of emotions.
I will say, I believe it was in that last episode, a little bit of I enjoy being cheeky sometimes.
No.
What?
But when I was able to say, finally, some good news when the comet came.
Yeah, oh, the comet's overhead.
Oh. We can get some speed. That was just so fun to... Okay, just a little backtrack. One final moment. I can't believe I didn't mention this. When I promised that I would never...
I can't.
I loved it. When I promised I would never walk away from my friends and go off and do something reckless without discussing it with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so dumb, but I enjoyed that very much.
I'm happy you're happy.
But yeah, and I guess the last thing that we haven't really talked about is Taekak.
Yeah.
We were only there for a moment, really.
I know, it was so brief.
It was a breath. We walked in, we saw your father, and... we roomed out so quickly. Which, the fact that location was so significant to both Jetsun and Amar, if, you know, we hadn't been, you know, literally racing the comet, basically, to get there on time, we could have unpacked a whole lot of mess in that place. You know, all it takes is the hat slipping one time, Amar getting annoyed and, you know, saying something at the wrong place and, you know, chaos ensues. So we were probably lucky that we only stayed for a second.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, I really wanted to paint a picture with Taekak. First little side note, a lot of the names I chose for this campaign are actual words in Asian languages. And there are a lot of them that I can't remember the exact meaning, but Taekak specifically is the Thai word for broken.
When did you choose that name?
Oh, which episode was it? It was before you guys left the Foggy Swamp. Amar has a vision about his hometown, and I mention at the end of that episode, yeah, something blah, 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 your hometown, Taekak.
Yeah.
And I Google translated it immediately before that.
Okay, okay.
Oh,
so
my
it was
gosh.
After we'd already kind of established that it was a broken place. I thought, for some reason, I thought it had been mentioned at the very beginning and you were just some sort of oracle.
But yeah, I wanted to paint a picture of somberness and uneasiness. This place that's kind of trying to pick itself back up. So the late evening sun rays coming through the lightly falling snow. One thing that I'm pretty happy with is having the little boy at the door, because I wanted to kind of set up the stakes in a way that provided a little bit of levity before we got into this really heavy final moment.
Yeah.
Oh, and he was so sweet.
So sad and confused.
He's just a poor boy.
Oh, and what did he call your dad? He called him something horrific and wonderful, like the Eraser or something.
Oh, so he just called him Mr. Ukami, but there was the sign outside the door that said Kizu Ukami Memory Removal... No, Heartache Removal Services?
Heartache Removal. Oh, that was wonderful.
I loved that picture that you did paint with the pink, golden sunlight / comet light, right, that we didn't notice before, and the lightly falling snow. That was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, it almost for Amar made it seem kind of dreamlike, like a painting, where it didn't quite feel real coming back to this place, and maybe the rest is a little hazy because of the snow obscuring things and that glow. the vision was very pinpointed on what was directly in front of us with my old house and the sign and Dad inside, and then we left.
Yeah, as much as I would like to claim credit for connecting the rosy golden glow of the sunset with the glow of the comet, I didn't realize that until the moment where I was like, oh yeah, the comet's probably here by now.
Ah, hey, well, it was great.
I mean, that's a big part of improv, just saying, yeah, that was the plan the whole time.
Yeah.
Yes. One thing that I did kind of mean to do, I mentioned in a previous talk back that the fight with the swamp swallower, I kind of wanted to reflect over the garden wall a little bit. I wanted Amar's father to reflect a little bit a character from Gravity Falls, who, this is one that I will refuse to spoil because it's such an impactful moment in that show.
Yeah.
But there is a character who deals with some very heavy memory removal stuff that is reflected very strongly in Amar's father.
I gotcha.
But one thing that I'm very grateful for with this interaction that you had with Amar's father is I'm so glad that Amar's father hadn't just completely forgotten him.
Oh,
yes. That would have been hard.
Oh, man.
That role.
Yeah, that was a risk that I made not just for you guys, but that I made for me as the GM as well. Like, we're just going to completely leave it up to the fate whether Amar's dad even knows who he is or not.
Yeah.
But I mean, it would have made the decision of whether or not to stay at the library a lot easier, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It would have been so heartbreaking if he just fully removed, you know, basically all memory of his wife and the child they had. And
something I'd like to just quickly hypothesize with that. If he's forgotten everything about your mother, right? But then he sees you and he's like, oh, you're my son. Like, you also came from your mother, obviously. Mm-hmm. In his memory, I would just be very curious how in his memory that correlates of, I've forgotten everything about your mother, but you came from your mother. And science, I don't know, you know?
I'll tell you what, you have to read the Stormlight Archive, McKenna. There's a beautiful example. This guy gets cursed. His wife's completely removed his memory.
Are you ruining things?
No.
Oh, I thought this
Dude,
was a...
for a second here, I was thinking you're like, you have to go read the Korra comics where they talk about, like, expand upon the brainwashing stuff. But here you are talking about Brandon Sanderson, of
Always.
Course.
Always.
Brando Sando.
But yeah, in terms of, like, what's going on in Kizu Okami's brain when he recognizes his son, at least to some degree. So when Gyatso and Lobe Sang came up to Jetsun and they were like, your friend's having a hard time getting his memories back. Well, I mean, Lobe Sang sees all these people that he remembers and has like all these things to physically be in front of him to jog his memory. Amar doesn't have that. That kind of stems from the only instance that we really see in the original show of somebody fighting against Aili brainwashing is when the gang are trying to bring Jet back from the brink. And the way that they do that is by like reminding him of who he used to be. So there's no like codified rules for how you remove the brainwashing effect from somebody. But we do see these examples of like when it's a strong emotion that they experience, that kind of stuff, which is why in the custom move, when you are confronted with a person, place, or thing that may unearth a memory out of your amnesia, it's kind of fast and loose, but I can definitely foresee like Amar's father is going to have his own journey to go on now that he's reunited with his son. He's going to have to go through some difficult things. But, you know, at least Amar will be able to go and visit him in his foxy little way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That helps a lot, especially with, like, the example of Jet. Because, yeah, I was like, how does that... science? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that works. Thank you. That really helped.
Yeah, no problem. And I think there is some poetry as well to the fact of, like I said, that whole stuff with electromagnetism that they explore later on in the Korra comics. The purpose of that is to make the brainwashing more permanent, less easy to reverse. And the fact that Amar's father discovers this technology and is like, oh, hey, this could remove the memories more effectively and more permanently, but then decides not to use it on himself, I think is significant.
Yeah.
He figured out about the boy spirits and the girl spirits.
Magnetism spirits. We need a t-shirt. That's a t-shirt.
What a callback, by the way, Ned.
Yes.
What a,
oh my goodness.
It was brilliant.
Yeah, that was back to episode 2, was it?
Was it
yeah,
really?
When we were on the way to the buzzard wasps, we were talking about following the magnetic center of the desert, and I tried to explain to you how magnets work.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was episode 2 or episode 3.
Yeah.
But yeah, very, very early on in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shoot, we've talked about pretty much everything at this point. Do you guys have any other final questions or things that you want to discuss?
Just say how happy I am that I was able to do it. It was wild, wacky, and weird in all the best ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all that I do have left to say is I'm so grateful. It was such a good story, a fun time recording, spending time with you guys, being able to just put together weird avatar shenanigans, and to be able to share that with people and honestly deal with my own stuff via my character. Like, it's been a long time since I have had fun doing RPGs. I mean, I've had fun, but just I felt burnt out, but this one I did not feel burnt out on even for a second. And that's how I kind of know that it was something that meant something to me. And so I'm just very grateful. And I'm grateful for the listeners for just trusting us and following along with each mistake we made.
And I mean, you were acting in two plays at once while we were trying to record this podcast. So the fact that you didn't get burnt out, even with all that going on, holy cow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love this. I mean, I am taking a break because I'm very tired, but I do love it.
Yes, a well-deserved break, I will say.
I just want to second, third all of that. I'm just so grateful that we got to do this. I'm so pleased with how everything turned out, how the whole story came together. It's so fun to look back at the entire process of what we did and realize, man, we actually did it. Like, Ned, props to you for doing so much. Thank you so much for putting it together and for everything you did. Thanks to you, Christian, and you, McKenna, for being along for it. And then especially all of you wonderful people listening out there. Thank you guys so much for listening to this weird made-up podcast that we do, because we love it and we're really glad that you guys love it too, because art doesn't exist without people to connect to it. So thank you.
Yeah. It's been a grand old journey, and we're very grateful we've gone on it. And I mean, I will kind of leave an open invitation that if you still have questions about this campaign, maybe you're finding it later on, you know, maybe you're a couple years down the road just getting to this point. If you have questions, I'll leave an open invitation that you can ask them to us, and we'll hopefully find a good way to get those answered for you down the line.
Heck yeah.
Because we're all over social media with handle at improvtabletop. We've got an email, improvtabletop@gmail.com. You know, we don't normally do plugs in the obligatory talkback, but there actually is one that I think is going to be a surprise for my players as well. We technically have our first real sponsor.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, a little bit of a story going behind this. Once upon a time, back in summer of 2020, I think it was, Ned backed a Kickstarter for a company, Metallic Dice Games. They were making these liquid-filled D20s that when you shake them, there's like confetti that swirls around inside of them.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, and I've been using these D20s for the past year or so and have really been enjoying them. They've become my main D20s. And just last week, I got an email from one of the guys at Metallic Dice Games who was like, hey, we're going to be rebranding next week. We're changing from Metallic Dice Games to FanRoll. We're looking for affiliates. Do you want to be a partner with us?
What?
So how kind of serendipitous that the first person who we're kind of partnering with is somebody who makes a product that I have legitimately been using every week for the past year.
Dude, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exciting stuff. So if you go to their website, I think by the time you are hearing this, they're supposed to have already rebranded. Look up Metallic Dice Games, look up FanRoll. It'll be at one of those places. They've got some really cool dice, including those liquid core filled ones. And if you use coupon code VroomVroomFifi, you can get 10% off your order.
No way!
FIFI, right?
Yep. VroomVroomFIFI. And if you do that, we'll get a little bit of a kickback as well from it. It's really happening.
I'm so happy.
It's so cool.
Oh, amazing.
My goodness.
So on that very bright note, everybody, thanks so much for listening. And those of you who are patrons, thanks for being our patrons, because it's through your generosity that you're making our dreams come true and helping us to produce more stories for all of our wonderful fans. Like I said, feel free to ask us any questions or make any comments or anything else related to our campaigns. Hopefully we'll be able to get those answers back to you, even though we're not in this campaign currently. But yeah, we'll be back sometime next year with our new Avatar Blades in the Dao Fei campaign. But until that point, I have been Ned Wilcock, one of the people who has actually completed a full podcast campaign, and I've been joined by...
Caleb Anderton, vroom vroom, Fifi.
McKenna Steele. Bye, y'all.
And Christian Randall, for the last time, Jetsun of the Library.
Much love and stuff, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Obligatory Talkback. Saying goodbye, why is it sad, makes us remember the good times we had. Something, something, Muppets Take Manhattan.
Something, something, Muppets Take Manhattan.
I love that. I've got one. How about Hags?
Classic.
Have a great
summer. Have a great summer.
Have a great...
Solstice.
That's solstice.
Solstice. Yeah, we're pretty close.
That's a lot sooner than summer, so we'll say that.
Yeah, that's what all of the Fire Nation citizens are saying as the Sozin's yeah. Comet approaches.
Have a great Sozin's Comet.
Have a great Sozin.
Have a great Sozin's
Comet. Oh, boy.
Dark.